Hello, everyone, from KQED's politics team. I'm Marisa Lagos, and this is Political Breakdown.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. On the breakdown today, we actually have a guest. We were a little worried for a while because he was on the bridge.
Traffic,
coming,
you know,
from Sacramento, but we will be talking to a Sacramento political consultant. He is, by the way, a Latino. He's working to get a Democrat elected governor. A Republican, he is.
Yeah, he's a Republican.
Yeah. Oh, that was, you're going to say that.
I was going to say that.
All right.
We're talking to Mike Madrid. He is here with us in studio.
But we got a lot to talk about for a few minutes before we bring Mike in. So should we start with DACA and immigration? Four bills up, four bills down in Congress. All some combination of border security, a DACA deal, immigration fix.
Oh, and one of them was
one
going
of them
after
was
sanctuary
not. Yeah,
cities.
Sanctuary
but, yeah.
cities as well. And they all fell short of, I think the one that got the most votes had 55 votes. And
54,
of course,
yeah.
they need 60 to get through the hurdle in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting about this is like watching how, you know, this is a president who came into office really promising to tackle immigration. And it seems in some ways like he can't get out of his own way on this. I mean, he was tweeting hours before the vote that he wasn't going to, that he would veto one of the bills, even though this was supposed to be
And they lobbied against it. The White House like pulled out the stops to stop it.
They apparently went on a conference call with reporters and wouldn't let anyone use the names of the people they were supposed to quote, which is always interesting.
And what's weird, one weird thing, too, is like Democrats are giving up all this stuff for something the president says he wants, you know, and yet they can't get to yes.
Yeah. And I think it's for us in California, you know, kind of fascinating to see how our two senators are voting on this. Dianne Feinstein voted for a couple of the bills, including one that was sort of seen as more the bipartisan real compromise measure. Kamala Harris voted against that.
She did, along with the two Democratic senators from New Mexico, another border state. But they, the three of them, did hold their votes back to make sure that they couldn't get to 60. I don't think any of them wanted to be the ones who prevented it from getting to 60. But when that became clear, they all voted no.
And of course, we should say, I mean, this is important because there is a March 5th deadline imposed by the Trump administration to repeal DACA. The courts have put that on hold. But in a state with, you know, almost a quarter million Dreamers, a quarter of the total number nationally, this is a big issue for politicians here. And I think that's something we're going to talk to Mike about in a little bit.
We definitely are. And it seems like what we have going on in Washington is a bit of a game of chicken, you know, between the Trump administration, the Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, and of course, stuck in the middle are these young folks, the Dreamers. What do they do? What do you do if you're a Dreamer right now? Do you go to college? Do you get married? Do you have kids? Do you apply for a student loan? Do you enlist in the military, or you just lay low and go, you know, go dark because you're afraid of what's going to happen? I mean, it's must be incredibly disruptive to their lives and, you know, their mental health, frankly.
Yeah, I think the back and forth is what's made this really difficult. And the fact is that this was something, you know, created by Obama sort of unilaterally, so to speak. But then the Trump administration decided itself to put this deadline on. And so
it's a crisis they created.
Yeah. It just doesn't seem like anybody in Washington is really willing, you know, or at least holistically to get together and get this done. The other thing I think we have to mention is the horrible tragedy in Florida. Yet another school shooting, 17 people dead.
And it's the same story, you know, over and over. There's outrage. Of course, there's grief. There's outrage. There's the, you know, now very much memed thoughts and prayers being expressed by politicians. And then there's a vow to do something. And then time goes by and it kind of fades. I mean, remember bump stocks after Las Vegas? And the NRA seemed to be even supporting that. And time is not the friend of people who want to get some kind of gun control passed in Congress.
Yeah, I mean, I think, too, like, it's like this happens and you start hearing about AR-15s and all these different guns and we kind of have this conversation. I think not just those of us in the news who have to pay attention to this stuff, but I feel like as a country, we're sort of weary on this. And I mean, it is kind of fascinating. In California, we've had, you know, for a long time, we've had very strong gun laws. We saw just this week a brand new supervisor in San Francisco, Catherine Stephanie, introduce a bill to take San Francisco's already very harsh gun control laws even further. This is around concealed carry at public events. But it just doesn't seem like it matters as much how much cities and states act when they're still.
No, you can't. You can't. I mean, they have to have a federal. I mean, if you have strict gun control in California, but Arizona, Nevada don't. I mean, how many Californians died in Las Vegas? You know, at that shooting, the guns cross the borders, you know, very easily. And, you know, we'll see if it becomes an issue. I mean, it's been sort of Obama tried to do something with it. Democrats have in recent years been a little gun shy. Pardon that pun. But we'll see if, you know, you'd think after Sandy Hook, if nothing substantive happens, then when will it?
And I think what happens in Florida will be something to watch. You know, we saw the governor sort of allude to the fact that he might be willing to talk about this issue in a way that, you know, the president certainly didn't. Republican. We've seen the county sheriff there have some pretty harsh words. And of course, this also brings up this issue of mental health.
Which was cut in the budget that the Trump administration put forward, funding for those kinds of things. So, you know, you have to look at what they're saying, but also look at what they're doing when it comes to policy and budgets and what are their spending priorities.
Yes. So that's a heavy one.
That's a big one. Big one. There were also in the last 24, 48 hours, a new entry into the governor's race. Amanda Renteria. Amanda Renteria, 43 years old, from the Central Valley. Great resume. Went to Stanford undergrad, Harvard Business School.
Worked for someone you might have heard of.
Hillary Clinton, in fact. First Latina to be a chief of staff for a U.S. Senator, Debbie Stabenow. However, people
she's
don't vote
talking.
For revenues. If they don't vote for resumes. Yeah, and she's not talking.
Yeah, it was a weird one. And I think, again, we're going to get to this with Mike in a second. But we should just say you had
grinning.
You basically had the situation where, like, bots showed up in people's Twitter feeds that she had filed for this office. She's not talking about it. It seems like her now former boss, Javier Becerra, the attorney general,
didn't really know this
was coming.
Yeah.
And
she's not talking, as you said. And there's really no, she has no website for her campaign. She's not returning media calls. So
it's an interesting way to launch a statewide run for governor.
Yeah, or end it, you know, perhaps. we'll find out.
Well, let's
now watch. She'll be governor, you know.
Yeah, right.
And we'll be, oh, man, Lagos and Schaefer.
She's going to play this
screwed
back.
Up.
Well, we're going to talk about all that and a lot more with Mike Madrid. He is in studio here. Right after this, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And joining us now, Mike Madrid. He is, among other things, the grandson of Mexican immigrants. He's an expert on how Latinos vote.
And as we mentioned at the top, he's a Republican working with a Democrat to get into the governor's office. Mike Madrid, welcome to the Breakdown.
Always great to be with you guys. I love that introduction.
You like
it's
that?
It's just a story of contradictions there.
Exactly. How'd you get into politics?
You know, I got into I grew up in a family down a Mexican family, obviously in Southern California, where politics was always part of the dinner conversation. Lively politics, by the way. And my parents weren't politically active, but they were very politically aware.
Hmm. What'd you talk about over dinner?
Oh, you know, was Vietnam a war, a conflict, and is Walter Cronkite biased or not? And you know, just
are they Republicans?
They were Democrats. Okay. Grew up in a family of Democrats, so I was kind of the pariah who got the. The cold leftovers, it's dinner. But, you know.
Wait. How old were you when you realized, Mom, Dad, I'm a Republican?
That I was different.
I
was 8 or 9 years old during the 1980 race for president. My first political memory was remembering yellow ribbons tied around
for the Iranian hostages. Yeah.
And feeling, even as a young child, that America had kind of lost its place in the world. And, look, the truth of the matter is, I think my parents were going through this kind of existential crisis, too, where kind of Reagan's famous line, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, the party left me. I know exactly what that sort of feels like now as somebody who's, you know, in mid to late, more mid than late 40s. But yeah, I mean, I get that.
You feel like the Republican Party's left
completely.
You, is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, there's very little left for me in the party. It doesn't mean I'm not a conservative, but increasingly being a conservative and Republican are two completely different things.
I want to talk to you about that, actually, because that's something I'm hearing, I feel like, a lot from people who are critical of Trump and him. But one thing, you know, for our listeners, like, when you're in a dinner party, for example, what do you tell people you do? How do you explain your job? Because I think when we say political consultant, not everybody knows what that means.
And that's kind of good sometimes when you're trying to have a nice dinner chat, because what happens is invariably, like, politics is one of those things where everybody is kind of an expert. And I truly mean that. It's not in a pejorative way. I mean, everyone's got their own opinion. It's just as valid as somebody else's. But it's not like you know, the physician story, come in, I'm a doctor, and says, I got an elbow problem, can you take a look at it? It really changes the whole dynamic. So when I say I'm a political consultant, I advise people on political campaigns. What I tend to transition to is I focus more on ballot measures than candidates. You don't really get into the party policy and stuff, especially in this environment. It makes family gatherings really challenging.
When did that become true, though?
Which part?
The weird,
you know, the avoiding saying you were, you know, working for Republican candidates.
It's always been there a little bit, but certainly in the last few years, I think probably the last 8 to 10 years, it's gotten really, really bad.
Why was it always there?
Well, I think, look, we always have it's been very easy to always fall into our partisan silos, right? And we have become the society that has really devolved into this tribalism, right? Where we've forgotten kind of, let me use a metaphor. It's kind of like being a Giants fan and hating Dodgers fans, right?
Like you just do it because
you just
have
do
to.
It because you have to, and you don't even know why, but you just
are. I mean,
are.
We may know why, but
well, no,
that's
and
a whole other
that's not, and I'm not, yeah, no, right, exactly. But Giants fans, but look, you soon lose the love of the game and the understanding of baseball when it's really more focused on the negative and the rivalry and the importance. And that's not to discount the importance of issues in politics; they are extremely important. But I do believe, as I have always believed, since I was that 9-year-old kid sitting at the dinner table, that we do genuinely have much more in common and have common goals that we're working towards than our policy differences might allow for.
Was there a tipping point for you where you just, you know, an issue, a candidate? I mean, Trump obviously alienated a lot of mainstream Republicans.
I mean, look, I was one of the most vocal nationally Republicans against Donald Trump, and you and I, we've all had this conversation for a long time. I happened to be in New York when he was coming down the escalator, and it ruined a trip because I ended up doing a ton of media, and you know, my poor girlfriend's like, "This is not why I came to New York." but yeah, and I'm proud of that. I mean, there was a moment where you stand up and say, "This is no longer what I stand for and what I believe."
And what do you think the Republican Party does stand for now, or what should it? Because I do think that it seems like, you know, the thing that conservatives have often said about liberals is it's all about identity politics. Mm-hmm. That seems like in some ways it's flipping.
Completely.
Because, you know, this is all about immigration. And
it's coinciding at exactly time this unprecedented demographic change is happening. The Republican Party is undeniably becoming the party of white identity politics. And it's funny because before really the 2008 campaign, we didn't talk about white voters because that was who you talked about. It was everybody. It was so enormous. But now, as whites are becoming a smaller, shrinking subset, they are becoming more racially polarized on both the right and the left. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. We'll talk about that maybe in the governor's race that's coming up, too. But white progressives often show some of the same proclivities towards race that white conservatives do. And it's just really this story about a changing California, changing America. And I don't say this, you know, facetiously, but it's been an honor to have spent the first part of my career in a California that was majority white, and the latter part will be spent when it's not, and to have seen that transition and be involved in it is really, really cool.
So you're working on the governor's race. Yeah. You're working for a Democrat, Antonio Villaraigosa. Why him?
Well, first of all, we have a really interesting, long and tortured relationship. I've known him for about 20 years when I was the Assembly Republican leader's press secretary and he was the speaker. And we had a very, very antagonistic relationship. It wasn't good. But through the course of time and his different roles and mine, we kind of got to understand and appreciate each other. And we both are very concerned about poverty issues of all things. And so through the course of different conversations, and as California has evolved and kind of separated into really two states by class with racial and geographic overtones, we started a discussion a few years ago on how to address this and talking about education reform and economic reform. And all of that really catalyzed into him saying, hey, I think you might want to be part of the team. And I was like, I don't know if that's a good idea.
Do I have to?
But that's an interesting question, because as a Republican consultant in a state that's becoming less and less Republican and more actually independent, I mean, not to be glib, but like, is this also job security for you?
No, fortunately, I'm in a position where I don't need to. I can choose my clients, let me just say that. And so it's an honor to be able to kind of decide who I want to work for. But you did say something that was very interesting. There is a disaffiliation with both major parties. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing demographically is people are now beginning to align their politics more based off of traditional class differences than ever before. And so you really see this two Californias we've been talking about in an abstract way. Where people are increasingly feeling they're falling further and further behind, crossing party lines, becoming independent, saying these two parties don't work. We need somebody who can really just tackle the issues unencumbered by most of the interests that tie us down in Sacramento.
And, you know, for decades, we've been probably since Prop 187 in 1994, you know, we've been talking about this phrase, which I never really liked, the sleeping giant, yeah. which is the Latino electorate. Yeah. And yet still punching below your weight in their weight, right? I mean, they're not showing up at the polls to the extent that they could.
Yeah.
Why is that, do you think? And especially in places like, you know, some of these congressional districts where there is a majority Democrats and many of them are Latinos and Republicans hold on to those seats.
Well, that's a great question. And it's something that I've studied very, you know, closely for the past 25 years. There's really only been two instances in the 25-year period where we have seen significant spikes in Latino voter registration and turnout. The first was right in the aftermath of Prop 187, 1994. The second was 2016 with Donald Trump's election.
And let's talk about 187 real quick. Like, explain.
I'm sorry, because I forget how old I am now.
No, I mean, but I just think not everybody remembers.
There are people who are voting now that were not alive in 1994.
Well, and there's so many parallels, it seems, between what happened there in the state for Republicans and what's happening nationally.
It's almost an exact parallel.
But I also want to say, like, we talked to Sean Walsh, who was also a Republican
consultant. Yeah.
And worked for Pete Wilson.
Yeah.
And, you know, has a more, I would say, nuanced view of Prop 187.
Yeah.
And talks a lot about border security and
all those things. And look, there is a fairness to that argument. Look, I was a young person in the profession during those times. Pete helped get me my start in politics. I've known Sean for 25 years, and he is exactly right. Our politics don't allow for that understanding, unfortunately.
We should explain what it was. It was basically a ballot measure that would say that if you were an undocumented immigrant, you could not access public services. And it passed, but it never went into effect because the courts basically threw it out as
unconstitutional. Yeah, so this would have prevented people from seeking emergency services, from undocumented children being in schools, basically the state providing any government services. It was viewed at the time as very draconian, but it won overwhelmingly, not just with Republicans, but with Democrats and with every demographic except for Latinos.
So why, coming back to the question,
So what happened shortly in the aftermath is something very peculiar. The decline of the Republican Party, the less competitive nature of the state, and also I would argue the lack of these aspirational candidates from the Latino community, candidly, that were drawing people positively to the polls. The only time historically we have seen the Latino community really rally and show up and in the numbers commensurate to its size of the population has been when there's this negative external threat. But there are a couple of anomalies, which I've, again, studied very closely. And in most of those anomalies, it was when Antonio Villaraigosa was running for mayor of Los Angeles. You saw this positive pull to the polls. And it wasn't just all this negativity that was scaring and frightening people that we're seeing. What is unique about this moment in time is you have that the DACA fears, the building a wall, the Trump factor that has catalyzed Latino voters, and you're going to have this positive aspirational candidate that has rallied the community, and I expect we'll have record turnout in this June election.
Not that you're biased in that way.
Not that I'm biased.
But Villaraigosa is not the only Latino on the ballot. I mean, we have a number of people with Latino names running for statewide offices. Alec Padilla, the Secretary of State, is one. Ricardo Lara, for insurance commissioner. Some of them are far more liberal Democrats. But are you hopeful that that is part of this, too, that it's not just one candidate?
Well, let me take a step forward, because, yes, there's no question. There is a possibility, with a month left to file, where you could have a Latino running for every statewide constitutional office. And that has never happened in California history, nor in American history, in any other state, which is, again, another drive to bring people to the polls. We are also seeing a record number of Latino candidates right now. I think we have like 400 or 500 more than we normally do at the city council and county supervisorial level.
But I'm curious what you said a moment ago, that they haven't been inspirational or aspirational in terms of, you know, inspiring people to vote.
Yeah. Well, what normally, and this is a criticism I've levied at both parties, and so I'm not saying anything new here, but normally, look, I've been polling Latino voters for 25 years. The top two issues continually are education reform and changes, and then economics, right? They're looking for the bread and butter issues. Those are rarely the issues you associate with the Latino vote. 9 times out of 10, it's immigration. It's driver's licenses for the undocumented. It's farm worker issues. And that's not to say that those aren't important issues, but they're never in the top 5, top 10 certain, you know, issues for Latino voters. And so, unfortunately, people in my profession kind of get a little lazy and say, oh, there's Latino voters. Well, let's talk to them in Spanish, and this is the issue that I want to talk about.
What about this issue? Because I wonder this, being part of several demographic groups, where we talk about, like, Latino voters or white voters or women voters. Like, I mean, you study this. Yeah. It's not a monolithic group.
No, it's not. The Latino vote, you mean?
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Or Asians, for that matter.
Asians are far more diverse than you see in the Latino electorate. But what we have found is since that some of that negativity in the 90s, it created a voting bloc where it didn't exist before.
Okay.
And that's why when we talk about the sleeping giant, it's hard to find a comprehensive agenda that all Latinos unite behind. But what they do unite behind are two things. One, an external threat to the community. You know when you are being attacked. You know when you've got people in your family circle or in the neighborhood who may be a DACA that's going to lose, a dreamer. And we also have rallied around a first mayor, a first state senator, a first governor.
But on the other hand, Cruz Bustamante ran for lieutenant governor and lost to Gavin Newsom.
Yeah, and he ran in the special election against Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I think
that's a whole other issue.
So yeah, I mean he didn't run against Gavin; he ran against Schwarzenegger, and that I think was explainable.
I do want to ask you about a new entry.
Yeah, I was about
race.
To do the
yeah,
same.
Yeah, yeah. So Amanda Renteria, obviously a Latina, jumped in sort of backwards. She was sort of a phantom candidate. I mean, there was a bot.
Yeah.
That tweeted out her candidacy because she filed some papers.
Which was clearly a mistake.
Clearly a mistake. She did not seem ready for the campaign.
And still hasn't said anything to the press.
No. So, why is she running, do you think? She isn't well known. She doesn't have much time or much money.
Or infrastructure or endorsements or support.
Yeah.
So, let me say this first. Amanda Renteria is a very accomplished person in her own right with an extraordinary resume, and I think would make a very viable candidate for virtually any office she would seek. But the awkwardness that you're pointing out is it's something just doesn't smell right with what's happened. She's far more aware and knowledgeable and intelligent to kind of allow this to be her rollout for a campaign for city council, let alone for governor. So we know something else is afoot. Look, we've been in the profession long enough. Here's what we know. You don't run for office and file 30 days out with no money, no endorsements, no infrastructure, and nobody really kind of back – or no campaign websites.
I mean,
there's literally nothing. The second thing is we know that if this does come out on Twitter and she's a presence, you answer the press and you at least allude to it, even if it's a very sloppy
rollout. Put out a statement.
We'll talk next Wednesday.
Have a two-minute video.
Answer a phone call off the record. Something.
Yeah.
It's just complete radio silence. The third, and this is, listeners, and this is where you really need to pay attention because it got interesting. What we also know is that Gavin Newsom's political consultant was hired by Javier Becerra's political consultants 2 weeks prior to this rollout. And this is going to continue to unfold. This is not the last part of the story. We're going to hear more about this.
But take that to the next step.
What are you saying there? You're basically
connect those dots.
What I'm saying is that it is really clear that this is not designed at this point in time because of the resources amassed to be a campaign that is going to challenge people that have been running for 2, 3, 8 years in some instances.
So you're saying maybe she's getting in to help Gavin Newsom?
I think that the dots are there.
It also seemed like Becerra didn't know she was running.
Yeah.
You think that was just manufactured?
I think it was sloppy all the way around and it caught a lot of people. Look, what happened, the way this story broke, let me make this clear too, is back in the old days, you could pull a statement of intent or a file and nobody would know until a reporter actually showed up and took a look at the filings.
But it's all automated in
Twitter now. So what happened was Twitter happened literally when I was on the phone with another reporter. It blows up on Twitter and people are going, what's happening? Phone calls are made. The Attorney General, Javier Becerra, was asked at a press conference on a totally unrelated topic. So it sounds like he had some inkling or there were some discussions about it, but didn't know that it was going to be happening in real time. And I think that it was just some general sloppiness on the part of, frankly, the political consultant that represents both campaigns.
So what impact does she have, do you think?
Potentially. Oh, very minimal. I mean, look, I will say this. Again, with a year's runtime on any of these offices, I think she probably could have made a real case. But I will say this: there are three other Latinos in that race right now who nobody knows. I don't expect. There is one possibility, and that is again the old adage in politics: follow the money. If you start to see Gavin Newsom supporter money, independent money, somehow showing up to support a campaign that doesn't have any infrastructure support, you're really going to know something is rotten. And this is part of a larger divide and suppress strategy with the Latino vote. That's just undeniable.
So that's what you think this is to draw votes away from Villaraigosa?
I think that, look, Amanda, again, is very accomplished. I think she probably got a little caught flat-footed here, too. I feel for her. Honestly, I do. I think that anybody running has a right and should be running. But you also, you know, are going to suffer the consequences if something like this happens and you're not prepared.
But why would somebody who, as you say, is very accomplished, she went to Stanford, she went to Harvard, she's got an MBA, she worked for Hillary Clinton,
yeah.
She has a future, she's only 43 years old.
Yeah,
so
bright
future. Why would somebody launch a campaign that it looks like it's, you know, could crash and burn, or certainly not done professionally?
Like, yeah, what is it? What's in it for her?
Well, why, yeah.
Well, I think you said it earlier before I came on, which is, was she 100% on board with this? We don't know. Does this botched rollout change the dynamics for her? I would think for her own political future, she would, you know, take a pause.
So you think maybe it was like a placeholder, just file the paperwork?
But she didn't have to. She has like a month, right, to do that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She precisely. And again, less than a month.
Yeah, but
anyway. Yeah, it's March 7th, 9th, something like that.
A couple weeks.
Look, this is in nobody's textbook on how to launch a campaign for anything, let alone the governor of the largest state in the union. I think that Amanda has a very bright future. If she does decide to stay in the race, we welcome. It's not going to change the dynamics of it. I just hope for her own future. She takes a deep breath, realize that she may have other people around her may have gotten her into a situation and she can rally with the community.
We just have a little bit of time left. But, you know, we've been talking about this governor's race. I would guess that a lot of people in the public are not following this as closely as we are.
Sure. I hope not.
I mean, what are you looking for in the next few months leading up to this primary, when we'll know who the top two are and who's actually in, you know, on the ballot?
What are we looking for in for the June primary election?
Yeah. Like, what if you're talking to people who are not super politically involved, like, what do you think they're going to be seeing and what should they be looking out for?
TV commercials.
Yeah, I think one of the misconceptions is that people are all consumed by what is happening in Washington, D.C. right now. There is a large segment of our population which is. It tends to be a little bit more informed and a little bit more aware of but there's the vast majority of Californians are showing us and telling us, even in public polling, we want people to start working together again, and we want governments to work. And we're not looking for this, you know, take one side or the other and let's stop the zero-sum politics. It's really distasteful. And I think we're at a bounce point where we can back off of kind of the extremist politics on both sides.
Really quickly, because we're almost out of time.
Sure.
Do you think how many of the 7 or 8 seats the Democrats have targeted that are held by Republicans, do you think that they realistically could pick up?
I think there's possibility of getting 2.
Okay.
Max.
You heard it
here.
Yeah,
I think it's highly unlikely, but 2 is probably the best position to be in.
All right.
At this point in time.
Thank you for coming in, Mike Madrid.
Thanks, Mike. We didn't even get to talk to you about your Domino's career with Domino's Pizza.
How do you remember that?
Zocalo.
Next time. Next.
Well, that's going to do it, though, for this episode of Political Breakdown. We'll talk to Mike about Domino's another time. To make sure you don't miss an episode, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. You can find that on Apple Podcasts.
You can also find it on NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts. Our politics team includes Katie Orr. Our producer is Guy Marzorati. And our engineer today, Seal Muller. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is the vice president of news and not a bad ping pong player, by the way.
I'm Marisa Lagos. Follow me on Twitter at @MLagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Follow me on Twitter. It's @ScottSchaefer.
That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown. We'll see you next time.